All right, let's pick up where we left off tonight in the book of Zechariah. We left off in chapter 14. That's the last chapter of this book. And I think it's kind of appropriate as being the last chapter. It really does tie together well in terms of what's going to happen at the very end of the age, the end of the world, and when Christ comes up and sets up his millennial kingdom, and what's going to happen in regards to the Jewish nation and the Jewish people. When Christ does return. Chapter 14 of Zechariah. First verse says, "Behold, the day is coming when the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you." Again, use that word "behold," and that word "behold" actually speaks of something that that happens virtually in an instant. Suddenly, you're surprised by it, you're overwhelmed by it, you're startled by it, and basically, what it's, I think is pointing to is the fact that when Jesus does come back, it's going to be sudden. It's going to be a moment when everything is going to change. Just when everything seemed totally hopeless and everything is in total despair, his return is going to be so powerful and so glorious that everything's going to be turned around in an instant. So he says, "Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you." In other words, he's talking about his people. The spoil is taken from his people by the surrounding nations that are eventually going to come up against Jerusalem, surround it, and they're going to encompass it, and they're going to strike Jerusalem and the Jewish people with a tremendous slaughter. I mean, what lies in store for the Jewish nation is going to be, I think, make the Holocaust look almost pale in comparison. Because Jesus warned about what was going to take place under the auspices of the Antichrist when he comes to power, and he's going to deceive the entire world, and he's going to enter into the covenant with the Jewish people, and 3.5 years into that covenant, he's going to break the covenant, and then the Jewish people are going to recognize that they've made a horrendous mistake in making a covenant with this son of perdition, or this man of evil, this basically the son of Satan. And then he's going to this Antichrist is going to wage all-out war against the Jews at this time. And then he's going to lead the nations against them. But it says very plainly, what's going to happen is God's going to turn this all around, and the ones that were out to plunder them and spoil them, they themselves are going to be plundered and spoiled. And it says in verse 2, "For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, and the horses' houses plundered, and the women ravaged, and half the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city." And remember, you have to tie this in with all other scriptures to get, a full picture of what's going to happen. 3.5 years in the tribulation period. Matter of fact, Jesus, when he forewarned about this, he says, when you see the abomination of desolation is taking place, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, okay, he says, if you're in the field, don't go back for your coat. He says, you know, pray that that day won't be on a Sabbath, or that you won't be nursing a child or pregnant with child, because he says, when that day happens, he says, man, you just have to run for your lives. And that day is going to happen 3.5 years into the tribulation period, when the Antichrist is going to go into the rebuilt temple, and he's going to declare himself as being God, and he's going to erect his image there and demand homage from basically the whole world, but the Jews in particular. And the Jews are going to recognize, well, we've made a terrible mistake, and it's going to be too late for most of them, because then the Antichrist is going to turn on them, he's going to break his covenant with them, and he's going to do all in his power to utterly annihilate and destroy them. Well, what it says is going to happen here, he says, I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured. Okay, and the houses plundered, and the women ravaged, or they're raped, and half the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off. Well, so this will begin to happen 3.5 years into the tribulation period. And they will be persecuted, and they will be hounded, and they will be fighting for their lives tooth and nail until Christ comes back and saves them. And it says in verse 3, "Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations when he fights, as when he fights on a day of battle." So it's going to be Christ who's going to deliver them, okay, from their enemies. They're going to be surrounded by their enemies. The whole thing is going to look so utterly, totally hopeless that they're all going to feel like we've had it. We're going to be wiped out as a nation, as a people. There's no hope for us. But remember, when Christ does come back and he does go to fight for them and he does go to battle for them, then we had read in chapter 13 that they're going to look upon him whom they have pierced, and he's going to come in great power and great glory and deliver them, and they're going to recognize him as the Messiah that they rejected and they crucified, and they're going to really, really be grief-stricken over their sin of rejecting the Messiah. And they're going to really have a broken, contrite spirit, and they're going to be there's going to be a true contrition on their part, a true sorrow and remorse for what they have done to their God and Savior and Messiah. Okay, but he's going to let them come to the point where they are utterly, totally in a hopeless situation, and then he's going to intervene on their behalf. He says in verse 4, it says, "And in that day his feet will stand upon the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from the east to the west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move towards the north and the other half towards the south. And you will flee by the valley of my mountain, for the valley of the mountains will reach to Aziel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him." Now, you know, you tie this in with the New Testament and other portions of Scripture, and you put this puzzle together. It really is amazing, because what it's basically telling us here is that when Jesus Christ comes back in great power, great glory, when every eye will see him, he is literally going to descend upon the earth, and his feet are going to land on the Mount of Olives. Now, remember, that's where he ascended into heaven. Remember, after his crucifixion and resurrection, then he continued to appear to various people for 40 days. And then after that, he appeared to a number of his disciples and apostles, and they walked up to the Mount of Olives, and then Jesus gave him his last, basically, commission and his blessings, and then he began to rise right before their eyes and ascend into heaven. And they were all watching him. They had their heads staring right into the clouds, watching him be carried up, and he disappeared into the clouds. And then, when they're all staring up there watching, two angels were standing beside the apostles, and they said, "You men of Galilee, why do you stand there looking up?" He said, "The same Jesus who has ascended into heaven will return in a like manner. And he will come back, and his feet will touch down exactly where he lifted off 2,000 years ago." But what's interesting, it says when his feet does touch the Mount of Olives, okay, there's going to be a tremendous earthquake. And the earthquake is going to be so severe that the mountain itself is just going to split. It's going to go from north to south. It's going to split. And it's going to split. And it's interesting that the Mount of Olives is just opposite the east gate of Jerusalem, okay? And the east gate of Jerusalem has been sealed up for centuries. And as a matter of fact, the prophet Ezekiel predicted that east gate would be sealed up, and it would remain sealed until the coming of the returning prince of the Messiah. What's interesting is that east gate is the gate which Jesus entered into on Palm Sunday. Okay? But since then, the gate has been sealed up. I don't know who sealed it up or when exactly, but it's been sealed up for centuries. And it was predicted by Ezekiel that it would be sealed up. But when Christ comes back and his feet touch on the Mount of Olives, there's going to be this earthquake that's going to split open this mountain. It's going to split right down and open that gate wide open. That's the interesting thing about that is that geologists have discovered that there is a fault underneath the Mount of Olives that actually runs right from the Mount of Olives underneath that gate. I mean, so it doesn't take too much of an IQ to put two and two together here to understand that, okay, when Jesus does come back in this terrible time of Jacob's trouble or the persecution of the Jews at the end of the world, and that gate is going to open, split wide open, and he's going to walk right through it. But it's going to form a valley. Okay, when that earthquake happens, the mountain splits and the gate splits open, it's going to split apart in such a way that people trying to find refuge from their enemies are actually going to go into that crevice. Okay, and that Jesus is going to walk through that crevice right through the gate into Jerusalem. And so he says here in that verse, start with verse 5 again. It says, "And you will flee by the valley of my mountain, for the valley of the mountain will reach to Aziel. Yes, You will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Now, we don't know anything about this earthquake, but it is mentioned in the book of Amos, and this earthquake had happened centuries before Zechariah had written this prophecy. So, in other words, this earthquake in the days of Uzziah the king must have been so severe and so, well, its magnitude must have been of such a nature that people were running for their lives in absolute utter terror, because it had to be of such a nature that hundreds of years later, centuries later, people were still talking about this particular earthquake. It says the earthquake that happened during the reign of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Well, he says that just like when people fled during that day, they're going to flee when this mountain splits, and they're going to flee for refuge inside this crevice. That's what it says. It says, an earthquake, flee before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him. Okay? How many times have we read this in Scripture? Old Testament, New Testament, prophet after prophet, apostle after apostle have proclaimed that when Jesus does return, he's coming with who? He's coming with all the resurrected saints, and apparently he's coming with the angels of heaven, the armies of heaven. He's coming with such power and such glory and such might, and they're all coming back with him. And, you know, with the grace of God, I hope that we're all in that particular bunch, that we're not left here to face God's judgments, that we do come back with him at that time. But he's coming back with all of his holy ones to reclaim his earth, this earth. And then in verse 6, it says that it will come about in that day that there will be no light, the illuminators will dwindle, for it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but it will come about that at evening there will be light. Here again is another amazing prophecy that in order to get the fulfillment of it, you have to take it in light of everything else that's foretold. It says here there's going to come a day where it's neither day nor night. What day is that? That day is when, remember what's going to happen, and John describes in the book of Revelation that one of the plagues that God is going to send upon the earth is that an angel is going to pour out his bowl or his vial upon the sun. The sun is going to nova. It's actually going to explode. When that happens, it says that men will be stricken with intense heat, and they will blaspheme the God of heaven because of the heat. Because it says that the sun will become as black as sackcloth. That's the way John describes it. And he says that the moon will become blood red. So you take all of this together like a big puzzle, and you'll see that at one of the final judgments of the world, it's going to happen when this angel pours out his vial upon the sun. The sun novas, or actually explodes, and then caves in on itself. The sun is about 900,000 miles wide. Okay, the gravitational pull upon the sun is just intense. Okay, and what's going to happen is once it explodes, once the thermonuclear fires within it cool to a point where the gravity begins to begin to pull it back on itself, it'll actually explode and then cave in on itself. And all the atoms and molecules that make up the sun are actually going to be crunched together, just smashed together in an incredible density. And the Bible describes the sun as becoming as black as sackcloth, that it will become pitch black. And it says the moon will become blood red. Well, imagine if the sun does nova, it actually explodes upon itself and it's hurling all of these gases and this debris and all of this, all of these things into space and actually into our atmosphere and whatnot. But once it does that, the light of the moon that reflects the sun will become blood red. I mean, it would be an eerie sight. And then eventually the moon will become completely black as well. And everything will be pitch black. So see, there won't be day or night. Interesting thing too, I've done a lot of extra biblical reading about some people who have, they're like the modern day prophets or seers that have communicated with the Lord in various ways. And you don't have to put any credence in what they say because it's not biblical, okay? But I test everything by Scripture. The Bible says, test all things or test every spirit because every spirit is not of God. And at the same time, we must prove all things and hold fast to that which is good. Anything that goes along with Scriptures or supports what it says, I don't have any problem in believing or at least being open to the fact that there's some truth there. And I do know that there was this Padre Pio who received a lot of different revelations, okay, about the end of the world. And he basically wrote, he said, there's going to be 3 days of darkness. And when the Lord comes back, it's going to be freezing cold. Now, I'm just to kind of take an excerpt from what he had written, but I think it's kind of interesting that if you take that and you can see how well it fits right in with what Scripture tells us. Remember, back in the book of Exodus, when God put the plagues upon Egypt, they had 3 days of darkness. Well, it was, the darkness was so intense, they wouldn't even move out of their own spot. And they were terrified by this darkness. Well, when the sun goes out, the moon no longer shines, and the stars are no longer give their light, everything's going to be pitch black. Okay? And right after that intense heat, without any sun, everything is going to begin to freeze. And so you'll see a situation where the world is coming to a literal end. I mean, Jesus himself said in the Gospel of Luke, he said these days are going to be so terrible, he said that unless he cuts the days short, unless he comes back and puts an end to it, he said no flesh would be saved. In other words, there wouldn't be a living creature left. I don't care whether it be man, bird, beast, insect, whatever. Everything would die on this planet. This planet would become nothing more than a burned out cinder. There would be no life left to it at all. Read it again as far as the light, okay? Verse 6, and it will come about in that day there will be no light. The luminaries will dwindle, for it will be a unique day. The unique day about it is that there's no sun. The sun is gone. There's no moon. It's a unique day, isn't it? Right? Which is known to the Lord. In other words, only God knows when it's going to happen. Isn't what Jesus had said. Okay, when he was on earth, he says that, it's a day that only the Father knows. He says, not the angels of heaven, not even the Son of Man. Of course, Jesus didn't know at the time when he was on earth in his humanity. He does now, okay? But it didn't mean that he wasn't God simply because he didn't know that. It's just simply that because in his human state, okay, he limited himself as a man. There was a lot of things that he couldn't do, okay, as a man, even though he was God. All right? But now he definitely knows that day and that hour. We don't know, not the angels in heaven know. It's known only to God when that day is going to arrive. But we have been given so many clues and so many things to look for that, in essence, God has pinpointed for us a time in history that all of this would come together. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, in Luke chapter 22, I believe, Jesus said basically that there would be a specific generation in which all of these things would come to pass. All these things would come to be fulfilled. What generation did Jesus pinpoint?
Generation that sees the fig leaf blossom.
Right. He said basically that the generation that sees Israel back as a nation will be the generation to see everything, all of these things fulfilled. And Israel's been a nation since May of 1948. In other words, almost for 50 years. Okay? In less than 6 months, it'll be 50 years that she's been a nation again. And believe me, it was the generation that saw this happen. Now, I was born in 48. I was born in July of 48. But I was thinking even today that I really wasn't the generation to see that. It was my parents' generation that saw it. So, in a sense, my parents' generation will not completely pass away until all these things will be fulfilled. See what I'm saying? I mean, we are literally at the very threshold of seeing this fulfillment. And it's just all culminating. We can see it happening. You know, all it takes is a little spiritual insight, a little understanding of current events, and a working knowledge of the Bible, especially Bible prophecy, to see it's all coming into place today. And it's all coming into play. So he says here that verse 7, for it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night. But it will come about that that evening there will be light. That's interesting, isn't it? Read it again. It says, for it will be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night. But it will come about that at evening time there will be light. So, in other words, that there won't be any sun, there won't be any light, okay? But in this pitch darkness, Jesus will come back in great power, great glory. Every eye will see him. And when he comes back, then everything's going to be illuminated again. And the sun is going to be rejuvenated again. And he's going to remake the world that man has destroyed. And those who have survived, that have given their lives to him, will go into the millennial period to repopulate the earth when Jesus sets up his kingdom. The earth will be such a total ecological disaster when he returns. Remember what John says in Revelation? He says the oceans are all turned to blood, all the fish have died off, all the fresh waters are turned to blood, all the green grass and the trees have been burnt up. Okay, you talk about a total ecological disaster. I mean, the whole world is just one big dying dead planet. So what happens, if you couple this with the book of Zephaniah, I believe it's in the first chapter of Zephaniah, Zephaniah says that it's coming a time when God will completely remove all things from the face of the earth. He said he's going to remove man along with the ruins, he's going to remove the birds and the fish, and everything's going to be removed, Zephaniah says, and then Christ is going to recreate the world. Because it'll be a dead planet when he comes back. This is going to be the end result of man wanting to be autonomous from God. This is going to be the end result of man trying to rule and reign without Christ. He's going to actually put an end to the world. And if Jesus didn't cut the day short, man would be putting an end to himself along with everything else. This is the end result of man trying to be his own God. Trying to, push God out of his life and run things for himself. This is going to be the end result. It's utter, total disaster. That's why Jesus will come back. And when he does come back, he's going to redo and recreate everything. Anyway, in verse 8, it says, it will come about in that day that the living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and the other half towards the western sea, and it will be summer as well as winter. So what it's saying is that when Christ sets up his millennial kingdom, okay, if you read in the book of Ezekiel, especially the last several chapters of the book of Ezekiel. Remember, we went through that a couple of summers ago, and I drew all those different diagrams of the temple, the millennial temple, and what it was basically going to look like as far as Ezekiel's description is concerned. Well, underneath the temple, there flows water, okay? And it flows in two different directions. One flows towards the Mediterranean Sea, one flows towards the Dead Sea, okay? And this water is like living water that, it everything it touches, life just really thrives. Okay? And even in the Dead Sea where this water will be flowing into. And it says it's going to be flowing summer and winter. It's going to be year-round. So the sun will be put back in its place. Okay? It will have its function. When Christ is ruling and reigning, there'll be evening and morning. There'll be the winter and summer. There'll be the seasons of the year for the 1,000 years of Christ's reign. All right? Then he says here in verse 9, he says, and the Lord will be king over all the earth in that day, and the Lord will be the only one, and his name the only one. That'll be a glorious day, right? I mean, to me, it says his name will be the only one. He will be the only one. In other words, there's not going to be this contention about who's God. Today, there's so many. The list goes on and on and on in terms of the numbers of gods that have been spawned over this planet, especially in India. I mean, there's so many gods and names of God from Kari Krishna. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Okay, people declare, say that Buddha is God, Confucius is God, Muhammad is God, Allah is God, this is God, that's God. Well, there's not going to be any of this confusion, okay, and total nonsense when Christ comes. He's going to be the one and the only one. When he's ruling and reigning in Jerusalem, okay, and he's going to be ruling and reigning the earth there. And then in verse 10 it says, and all the land will be changed into a plain from Gibeah to Rimeon, south of Jerusalem, but Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gate as far as the place of the first gate to the corner's gate, and from the tower of the Haniel to the king's wine presses. And what's going to happen is that Jerusalem itself, okay, for basically miles around, there's going to be a level plain. Jerusalem will be elevated, and the city will be there, okay? And the city gates will be there, but it'll be a plain. As a matter of fact, if you read in the book of Ezekiel, when he describes the millennial temple, he does describe how various portions of this land that's surrounding Jerusalem will be portioned out to the various tribes of Israel, okay? And it'll be a broad plain at that particular time. Because when Christ does come back, remember, the whole world has basically, remember we're told in Revelations, other portions of Scripture, that the world is going to experience a phenomenal earthquake where every island is going to be moved out of its place and every mountain is going to be brought low. I mean, the whole topography and geography of the world is going to be transformed because of the destruction of this planet. And one of the things that's going to happen is it's going to be a broad plain in Jerusalem, where it's going to be, you know, basically a plain that's surrounding the city where Christ's temple is in the center of it. And this plain, of course, is going to be divided up among the various tribes of Israel when he does return. And then he says here in verse 11, it says that the people will live in it, and there will be no more curse, and Jerusalem will dwell in security. Well, obviously, this is all future. When it says there will be no more curse, well, during the millennial period, there will still be death, okay? But it will be minimized, all right? There won't be until the eternal state that death will be totally and completely abolished, and that the second law of thermodynamics will be completely repealed. In other words, second law of thermodynamics says that everything goes from the complex to the simple. Everything breaks down, deteriorates, crumbles, dies, decays, right? Well, that's because of sin. That law entered into our universe. And that law is part of the curse. Well, eventually, in the eternal state, that curse will be completely repealed, or that law of second dynamics will be completely repealed, and there will no longer be a curse. But even in the millennial period, you will see a great deal of the curse that has been placed upon mankind because of his rebellion and his sin will be lifted. And Satan and all his demonic horrors will be bound for 1,000 years. There will be complete and total economic justice and prosperity. There'll be there won't be the racism, the bigotry, the wars, and the fighting, and the constant bickering that goes on among the nations today. And in verse 12 it says, "Now this will be the plague of which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet, and their eyes will rot while they're rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouth." Does anybody's Bible say consumed? Mm-hmm. Does anybody's Bible say that their eyes will be consumed, their flesh consumed, their tongue? Well, that's really literally the word. Okay, that their eyes will be consumed out of their sockets, their tongues will be consumed out of their mouths, their flesh will be consumed off their bones. Now, before the advent of the atomic bomb, this would be very difficult to understand. Because now keep in mind here, look at what it says. Let's reread it. Let me paraphrase it a little bit. "Now this will be the plague of which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they're lying in their beds." No, that's not what it says, is it? You see, if it says their flesh will be consumed while they're lying on their beds, and their eyes will be consumed out of their sockets while they're lying on their sick bed, or their flesh will be consumed off their bones as they're lying on their deathbed, well, then you would think, well, this is some kind of wasting disease, right? That this is something that's just, worse than AIDS, that's completely disintegrates a person's body over a period of time. But no. This is telling us that people are walking along on their feet, and then all of a sudden their eyes are consumed out of their sockets, their flesh is consumed off their bones, and their tongues are consumed out of their mouths. Well, we know from what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, okay, when the atomic blast went off there, we know what took place, right? Many of the survivors told stories of people whose flesh was actually, consumed right off of their bones while they were walking along on their feet. All right. So basically what this is saying, read this again and tie it in with what we know today and what are we capable of. And you could see, I think, to me, a very plausible explanation for what this means. When it says, "Now this will be the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples that have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet." They're walking along and this is what's happened. Okay. "And their eyes will rot," or literally consumed, "in their sockets, and their tongues will be consumed in their mouths." Well, we know at the very end of the world there's going to be an all-out nuclear exchange. And this is what's going to be one of the plagues that's going to happen to people. And you tie this in with what John refers to in Revelation. John says that he saw 100-pound hailstones coming down on people. And I mentioned before when we went through the book of Revelation, when there's a nuclear blast, you see how the blast itself literally pushes out the atmosphere. Just with intense heat and just a tremendous pressure, pushes it out, but it creates a vacuum. And once it's gone out as far as it can go, then it comes back in. And it all comes back in on itself, and that's why you see this big, huge mushroom cloud that shoots up in the air. Well, when that comes back in, all this intense heat is going to go shooting straight up into the atmosphere at tremendous speeds. This tremendous hot air that's going to collide with all the cold air up on top. And it's going to all come down in huge, massive hailstones. And they have done experiments where they have had nuclear tests where they've created this type of hail to come down. Then the hail was so big and so large. I mean, it's literally dented armor plated steel on tanks or on ships. But John describes it as being 100-pound, you know, balls of hail. I mean, how much does a bowling ball weigh? 20 pounds, 16 pounds, something like that. Imagine 100-pound hail coming down. You've heard of black rain, right? I mean, it was referred to in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the atomic blast went off, and that, you know, this hot air goes up into the atmosphere and it hits that cold air and it comes down as black rain. Well, this is going to come down as black hail, 100-pound hailstones. I mean, it's just going to be absolutely devastating. So you can see, you tie this in with all Scripture, and you can see that, yes, mankind is going to bring himself to the total brink of annihilation in a nuclear sense. He says in verse 13, "And it'll come about in that day that a great panic of the Lord will fall upon them, and they will seize one another's hand, and the hand of one will be lifted up against the hand of another." And that's what's going to happen at the end of the world. All the nations are going to be in such a panic, they're going to be firing at each other. Okay, all the nuclear weapons. And then in verse 14 it says, "And Judah will also fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be gathered to gold and silver and garments in great abundance." And Judah, of course, they don't know their tribes today, but there'll be a remnant of the Jews who will be fighting tooth and nail at Jerusalem and trying to defend themselves. But remember, Jesus is from the line, the tribe of Judah. He's referred to as the line of Judah. If you go back, I think it's the 49th chapter of the book of Genesis, and when Jacob was dying, he blessed all of his sons, and he gave a prophecy that the scepter, or really the ruling staff, the ruler, will not depart from Judah. And Jesus is the line of Judah. He comes from Judah, and the tribe of Judah will be the one that will be basically dug in and fighting tooth and nail for their survival until Jesus comes back to deliver them. Also, that when he does come back, there, you know, all those who went to despoil God's people, they themselves will be despoiled, and the Jewish people will end up with all of this great wealth. And then it says in verse 15, "So also, like this plague, will be the plague on the horses and the mule and the camel and the donkey and all the cattle that will be in those camps." And of course, the unfortunate thing is, when you do have an all-out nuclear exchange, or even a limited nuclear exchange, I mean, it's just not mankind that's wiping himself out. He's wiping out, you know, every other creature on the face of this planet. Okay, that's obvious. Okay, and we, you know, the unfortunate thing, because of man's sin, all of creation is now groans, as Paul says in Romans, under this curse that we're under. I don't care whether they're animals or man. We are all under the same kind of curse. And then in verse 16 it says, "Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went up against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths." Now, I think this was your question last week, Phil, about, well, who's going to be left? What's going to happen to the other nations? Is this just going to be Israel left? No. In spite of the fact that there's going to be nations that are totally annihilated, and Isaiah says that God is going to make men scarcer than gold and the pure gold of Ophrah. In other words, right now we've got over 6 billion people on the face of this planet, and I think that that number is going to be so radically reduced there'll probably only be a few hundred thousand people left by the time it's all over and done. But they will be representative from virtually every nation that survives. And so what it says is that it says in verse 16, then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went up against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to celebrate the Feast of Booths. So what's going to happen when Christ recreates the world after man made a mess of it is that people are still going to, there's still going to be various nations. And then the nations are going to be repopulated during that particular time. And every nation is going to have representatives that represent that nation to go up to Jerusalem every year to worship the Lord and celebrate the Feast of Booths. Okay, what is the Feast of Booths? Anybody remember?
Feast of Tabernacles was
right.
Another name.
Same, it's another name.
They celebrated their wandering in the desert for 40 years.
Right, very good. I mean, it was something that was required. One of the feast days that required all the males to go down to Jerusalem once a year to celebrate this particular feast. They call it Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. And what it was that for several days, the people had to make themselves makeshift booze, okay, out of whatever they could find. They had to make themselves a tabernacle or a booze or a little bit of a makeshift hut. And they'd have their kids with them, and they'd have to live in these huts, okay, for just a few days. And it was to be a reminder to the people of how God not only delivered them from their enemies in Egypt, but how he sustained them, you know, and through their wanderings in the desert, okay? And this is one of the ways that they were to teach their children how God was there to deliver them and provide for them and watch over them and protect them. This is something that they are going to be required to do, the world's going to be required to do during the millennial period, is that once a year they're supposed to go up and celebrate this feast. And this is something that is always to be pointing back to, reminding how God had delivered his people, how he delivered actually the world from its total destruction, how he did, and how he delivered mankind from sin. The whole thing would be basically reenacted once a year so that their memory would be reinforced as far as the things that God had done for them, and then the new upcoming generation will have a clear understanding of what God has done for his people. Okay, and then it says in verse 7, it says, it will be that whichever of the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of the host, there will be no rain on them. So here's an interesting thing, okay? You got a situation where if there's any nations on earth where they don't send representatives go to Jerusalem once a year, then they're going to be denied rain. See? And if we just look at the fact that God is in control, total control of all weather, right? And he's using weather as a means to try to get men's attention. There's no question about it. Except that most men are just completely blinded to that fact. We're talking about this El Nino, you know, and everybody's, you know, bracing themselves for one of the biggest, severest winters on record or whatever. And all I can say is, hey, this is another means or another way in which God is trying to warn men, trying to get to speak to men. But, of course, men don't listen. They don't pay attention. You know, rather than saying, hey, this El Nino is from the hand of God, and he's trying to really wake people up and get our undivided attention so that we can get our priorities right, no, they just assume, well, this is just something we'll just have to deal with. Well, even during the millennial period, God will use the weather to try to get men's attention if they're not living up to what God's expectations are. Okay, and then he singles out Egypt here when he says in verse 18, and if the family of Egypt does not go up or enter, then no rain will fall on them. And it'll be the plague on which the Lord smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Now he singles out Egypt. Now Egypt is somewhat of a dry, arid nation, country. Okay, they don't get a lot of rainfall. They depend a great deal upon the Nile for their irrigation and for their water. Okay, but I think he singles out Egypt for the very fact that they are an arid, dry nation that doesn't get a lot of rainfall. In other words, he's simply saying that, hey, even the nations that don't get much rain, okay, they're going to feel the curse of this plague or this punishment if they do not respond, if they do not obey, if they do not come up, if they don't send a delegation of representatives up once a year to worship the Lord and to commemorate the Feast of Booths. Then he says in that verse 19, and this will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. And then verse 20, in that day there will be an inscription on the bells of the horses, holy to the Lord. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the bowls before the altar. And every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to the Lord of hosts. And all who sacrifice will come and take of them and boil them. And there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord. Now, Lord of hosts in that day. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing. It says that even the bells on the horses will have inscribed upon them, holiness unto the Lord. Anybody remember what was holiness to the Lord inscribed upon? Anybody remember in the Old Testament? If you remember reading in the writings of Moses, he said that on the turban of the high priest, he had to have this gold band that went around his turban, and on the gold band it said holiness unto the Lord. Now the priest couldn't see it, okay? The high priest didn't see it, but it was on the band. It was written there. It was for everybody else to see, and that's what true holiness is. True holiness is not something that somebody's aware of. They don't see it in themselves. okay? But other people could see it. I thought kind of an interesting thing is that they were interviewing Mother Teresa before she had died, and they were just asking all kinds of questions. And one of the questions that says, "Do you believe that you are a saint?" And she kind of shrugged her shoulder and says, "Well, isn't that what we're all called to be?" I mean, this woman was just kind of really self-forgetful. It wasn't like, well, you know, I'm really excelling myself or, you know, above everybody else. She just recognized, hey, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. Okay? Everybody else could see something about her that she was just, I don't want to say if she's unaware of, but she just simply was not focused in on. Simply because, why? She was, her life was dedicated to God. There was an article today about just teen girls, and they've never been challenged like they are today. And some of the articles that I've been clipping out, I don't want to get into these, but into depth on them. But the interesting thing is, they had one article had written that there's back in the in 1892, they found a diary of a girl, of a teenage girl, who wanted to make some changes in her life, and she wrote in her diary, quote, "Resolve not to talk about myself or feelings, to think before speaking, to work seriously, to be self-restrained in conversation and actions, not to let my thoughts wander, to be dignified, interest myself more in others," unquote. Now, this is a teenage girl back in 1892 who wrote this in her diary. She wanted to make some changes about herself. Okay? You see what she was focused on? She was, you know, she resolved not to talk about myself or feelings, to think more before speaking, to work more seriously, to be self-restrained in conversation and actions, not to let my thoughts wander, and to be dignified, interested in others more than myself. Now, here's a diary. This is an excerpt from a diary of a young teenage girl in 1982. And today is no different, because I just read an article today just confirming all this. And this is what this girl writes. "I will try to make myself better in any way I possibly can with the help of my budget and babysitting money. I will lose weight, get new lenses, already got a new haircut, good makeup, new clothes, and accessories." Okay, now, and this article here goes on and it talks about how girls today are so obsessed with their looks that 1 out of 5 is, they are so obsessed with their weight that they have eating disorders, and their whole focus is upon themselves and their looks and how they look. I mean, this is where we are at today, right? Well, this is not holiness unto God, is it? By any means. When a person can get their eyes off themselves, get their eyes on Christ, their life is going to begin to emit a type of holiness, right? That maybe they are not conscious of, but other people are going to be aware of. And the interesting thing, too, is that it says here that there's going to be on the bells of horses and on the just common everyday bowls and utensils, it's going to be basically, these are all going to be holy. So what we see here, I think it's pretty interesting, is that when Christ sets up his millennial kingdom, even everything that's in the secular world or secular things are going to be holy. Look at where we're at today. I just got this in the mail the other day. I think it's kind of interesting. It's just a letter in regards to this Judge Moore in Alabama. I said Alabama. I hope I'm right. Anyway, he's the judge that wants to keep the Ten Commandments on the wall in his courtroom, and he opens every session with a prayer. And now the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, is now suing him. Okay? And he's standing fast. But what I'm saying here is, look at the contrast that we see in the world we live in today. You can't pray in school. You can't read the Bible in school. A judge cannot even have the Ten Commandments on his wall without somebody taking offense and somebody wanting to sue, right? He can't open his court sessions in prayer. Well, this is going to be none of this nonsense when Christ comes back. He says here, even the secular things, ordinary things, the harnesses on horses are going to have holiness to the Lord written on them. You know, bowls that are just ordinary, everything's going to be, you know, focused on the Lord. You're not going to see this, you know, a situation where we have a separation of church and state. No. Everything's going to be Christ-centered, and everything's going to be pointing to Him, and everything's going to be in total peace and harmony. Anybody have anything want to add or share?
Yeah,